you suffer from chronic CFED or can't focus energy drain? Try over-the-counter Vibrin. One tablet contains the same caffeine as a cup of coffee, but without the calories or coffee breath. Vibrin. Caffeine, not coffee. Taking Vibrin may result in increased productivity and decreased dread in setting alarms. Unexpected enjoyment of the graveyard shift has been associated with Vibrin. Vibrin may be a better budget option than drinking coffee. It may also decrease the urge to doze off, skip work, or exhibit signs of slacking. All jokes aside, always read the label, take only as directed, and limit caffeine as it may cause real side effects. Not for children under age 12.
Hello and welcome to the seventh episode of the Hope Illuminated podcast, your source for the stories, science, and strategy of suicide prevention and mental health promotion, where we live, learn, and work. I'm your host, Dr. Sally Spencer-Thomas, and I'm on a life mission to empower communities with solutions that help people overcome isolation and despair and rekindle a passion for living. Each episode, we're joined by international experts who inspire hope and offer real guidance. Welcome to the show. I'm so glad you're here. Today is a very important day with a very important guest. As we're recording today, this is my 13th death anniversary of my brother's suicide, and so I'm very much in a space of reflection, and as soon as the podcast recording is over, I'm going to spend the rest of the day doing some of my grief rituals and contemplating on why I do what I do. And so it's very appropriate today that I have my dear friend and esteemed guest, Dr. Quincy Lazine, here to talk to us about hope. And for me, coming through not only the grief of the loss of my brother, but also some different points of depression and other life struggles like many of us have, finding hope in that darkness has been the thing that's helped me get through, whether that's a relationship or some future opportunity. And so I just recently wrote a blog called, Finding Hope as a Defiant Superpower Against Despair. And I just wanted to read this poem that I came across. So as I was thinking about this, I went to my faith community this past Sunday, and our senior minister, Wendy Williams, read this poem. It's called The Gates of Hope by the Reverend Victoria Safford, and it goes something like this. Our mission is to plant ourselves at the gates of hope, not the prudent gates of optimism, which are somewhat narrow, not the stalwart, boring gates of common sense, nor the strident gates of self-righteousness, which can creak on shrill and angry hinges. People cannot hear us there. They cannot pass through. Not the cheerful, flimsy garden gate of, you know what, everything's going to be all right, but a different, sometimes lonely place, a place of truth-telling about our own soul first of all and its condition, the place of resistance and defiance, the place of ground from which you see the world, both as it is and as it could be, as it will be, the place from which you glimpse not only struggle, but the joy of the struggle. And we stand there beckoning and calling, telling people what we're seeing, asking people what they see. Now, I love that poem because I do think there's many ways to see hope, to experience hope, and I would also say to practice hope. And so I'm just going to cover briefly a couple of daily practices that I think about sometimes, and you could go to my website, sallyspencerthomas.com, to get the full blog and the explanation and some other resources. But some daily practices that we can focus on when we're feeling hopeless is, number one, we can actively try to think about choosing hope. And so, for example, if we see a decision that's very discouraging to us, or if a person in our lives acts in a way that's disappointing, we can choose to believe things about that. We can choose to have hope that maybe there's a different motivation or a different outcome coming from it. We can also choose to imagine hope. We can create a vision for ourselves that is a different type of life or a different type of opportunity. And, we might not have a direct route there, but as long as we're holding that vision for ourselves, that's light in the darkness. Sometimes we need to borrow hope, right? So if we can't see it for ourselves, we need to surround ourselves with people who can see it for us, and we can borrow it from them, or they can just hold it for us in that interim. I like the idea of spreading hope, and I think that hope is far more possible when we're doing it in groups. And so we can do this in advocacy groups or peer support groups where, you know, together we are more hopeful than we are alone. And then the final piece, which really ties into our guest today, is about persevering hope. You know, it's really that long arc, a long arc sometimes with many disappointments in the middle and some, you know, sometimes major losses, tragedies, and transitions, that if we persevere and believe that there's really something else on the other side of that despair, sometimes we can live through, we can often live through a number of challenging things. So that's what we're really talking about today. It's about making meaning. And just a couple of days ago, the TED Talk that I recorded in November was published. And so I'm very excited to share that with you. Again, you can find that on YouTube, on TED Talk. Just search my name and it comes up. And really what I talk about there, which I know DeQuincy is going to share with us today, is the power of our narrative, the power of sharing our story as a way to kind of reclaim our lives, make connections with other people, and really start ourselves on, you know, for some of us, a social justice journey to help others who might be struggling with similar experiences. So I'm super excited for this conversation. I'm very, very thrilled that DeQuincy said yes when I asked him if he'd come on. He's incredibly busy. He holds many, many positions, and it's just truly an honor. So for those of you who don't know, DeQuincy is a suicide attempt survivor, and he's been active in suicide prevention since 1996. Now, he is not in retirement age whatsoever. He's a very young man. So he started off this journey when he was incredibly young, and he's really been a pioneer in the effort. And that seems funny to call him, a pioneer, because usually you wait for like end of career to use those words. But he has been a pioneer since his young adult years. And that's hard. It is very hard to be the forerunner in this space, because of, you know, it's just when you're like one of the only people who's out as a suicide attempt survivor, that's a lot of weight to carry in the backlash from the world and also for the expectations of everyone behind you. But he's done such an amazing job with his career and his life. He's a PhD in clinical psychology from UCLA, and he got his postdoc at the University of Rochester, which is one of the preeminent research labs in the whole world. So he's not only coming to our conversation today with his lived expertise, but also his clinical expertise and his research expertise. He and I crossed paths in a number of places, and so I'm very honored to be his co-chair for the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline's Consumer Survivor Committee. So together we help inform the Lifeline's work through the voices of lived experience on that committee. He's also the current chair of the Attempt Survivor and Lived Experience Division of the American Association of Suicidology, the first chair, I should mention. So also kind of carving out the vision for this very important part of our field's work. He was the primary author for the paradigm-shifting document that I've mentioned several times on this podcast and in my blogs, The Way Forward, where people with lived experience are informing how we can do better in our clinical work and prevention work and policy and integration of people with lived experience at a very deep level. And he's also the author of 8 Stories Up, Choosing Hope Over Suicide, and 13 Answers for 13 Reasons, which is in response to that Netflix series that came out earlier this year. Currently, we're also collaborating. He's the CEO of Prevention Communities, and so we're working together on how we can help people integrate lived experience into systems and cultural change. So that's a long list of really impressive accomplishments. So without further ado, my pleasure to introduce my wonderful friend, Dr. Quincy Lazine. DeQuincy, how are you today?
Yes, thank you. I'm doing well. Great. Thanks. How are you?
Good. Will you please take us on a little bit of a journey with you and share with us a little bit about how you got here and really focusing on the points in your journey where you found yourself trying to make meaning in the things that you had gone through?
Sure thing. I'd say that probably the really key part of October 1st, 1995, I was a first year at college at Brown University, so Providence, Rhode Island, probably some 3,000 or so miles away from where I grew up in Los Angeles. So it was kind of a cold night. I was feeling a lot of pain and frustration after getting off the phone with my mom and talking some about family things and having some things come up there. Also thinking about kind of feeling I'm still alone at college, even though I was surrounded by a lot of people who I liked, a whole community of people who I really enjoyed being with, but I still felt very alone and in pain and frustrated. And so that night, I ended up doing a lot of suicidal risk-taking, and kind of the value that I had placed on living really started to deteriorate at that point in time. But I'd say that the my journey in trying to make something out of that also started that night when I got back to my dorm room, having survived the various things that I had done that night, and started trying to make some sense out of what was happening by writing it down in my journal and journaling. And that's something that I will touch on a little bit later, is something that folks and the research community have said is important in trying to make meaning out of one's experience. But so I started writing about it in the journal and trying to figure out what was going on inside, trying to put everything together to kind of understand what was going on internally.
Wow, that is, I don't know that you've ever painted that picture for me of that night before in that way. And just the feeling I'm having right now, imagining you there, you know, alone and frustrated and kind of testing out your own mortality is deep and powerful. And I'm so glad you had that journal with you as a way to kind of process that moment. So what happened next?
So I got back to the room at like 3 a.m. or something. And so my roommate was asleep. I just wrote at my desk, just kind of a small lamplight, and just journaled for several pages and trying to figure out. I think I wrote to myself something along the lines of, if you wake up tomorrow and think this was a dream, it wasn't. This was all real, and here's what happened, and here's why. And then after that, kind of went back and forth in times feeling really down and suicidal, and in times feeling like things were going to be just fine. But always kind of writing and sometimes writing to friends. And I think trying to explain my experience to other people helped me to try to figure it out for myself better, so that I could actually explain it and feel like they could understand it. I think that kind of my experience mixed together with just my general personality, which is to try to make sense of things, try to understand things. I'm kind of a researcher by nature, trying to figure out kind of what's going on in the world around me. And also have always wanted to be involved in some kind of cause. So being involved in a cause, as well as trying to understand what was going on inside of me, is what led me towards switching from computer science and graphic arts, which is what I was in before, over to being in psychology and getting more involved in the mental health field.
Was there a turning point at all in these early days, a moment when you knew, when you had resolved that things needed to be different or that you were on a different journey? Was there like a crystallized moment at all?
For sure. There were many. I think one that comes to mind, actually, which is very much in line with our theme, is when I lost my therapist, the first therapist that I really connected with, who was my therapist in college, and my best friend had put me in touch with going up to psychological services, which took a lot of courage at the time because I didn't know what to expect and had a lot of stigma around mental health services that I carried with me. But I connected with her, with Maria Teresa, and then that winter, so winter of 95, her and her family died in a plane crash. They were traveling down towards, Colombia, traveling down towards Colombia for Christmas, and their plane went down. It crashed in the mountains. So when I got back to campus for the spring semester, I was told, your therapist has died in this plane crash. So I had to try to figure out, how do you make sense of this? this type of loss. And so one possible explanation was just that I invite calamity into my life, and so bad things just kind of happen to me. But another opportunity was just, you know, do I value her opinions even more now that she's gone? Does the things that she said resonate more? And so I ended up leaning in that direction. And so she's still one of the people who I dedicate some of my work to sometimes, because by continuing on, it kind of fulfills her vision of me as having a positive future.
Oh, that guy ties right back into what I was saying earlier about choosing hope. You have different ways you could have interpreted that situation, and you chose the way that brought her even closer to you.
Right.
That's made a difference.
Yep.
Yeah. Yep. Wow. And so this was all a while ago. What other parts of your path have you found that this making meaning piece of your journey gives you that energy or insight into doing what you do?
Another one that very similar to my therapist loss was when I lost my best friend, the one who did get me over to psych services. She was killed by her sociopathic boyfriend in New Mexico. Yeah. That happened when I was in grad school. So when I had that loss, it was kind of, you know, this is the person who I really turned to, the person who I wrote to very often, somebody who got me through a lot of my hardest times. So I had to think, you know, am I doomed to just lose people? It's something that I still kind of grapple with many times, is just kind of, you know, having these types of losses. I mean, because I've had somebody in my life die by gunshot and then by strangulation, two people who died in airplane accidents, one in a train accident. So just kind of all these things that are statistically not supposed to happen
rare,
that often, right? Supposed to be very rare. So have tried to come to the conclusion that I have just had an extraordinary life and have met lots of different people who do all kinds of experiences. And so since I've traveled so widely and have met so many people who are just kind of out and living and traveling, these things are probably more likely to happen to those people. But it's still kind of how do you make sense out of these things that have happened in your life? How do you interpret them? What story do you tell yourself about it? And I've tried to tell myself a story that's kind of either more positive or at least something that comes to a conclusion that's not as negative and dire, but it's a struggle. It really is.
And that really is based in this whole theory that I'm coming to learn and love, which is that narrative psychology theory. Are you familiar with that? It's where, I'm not an expert on it by any stretch, but what I started learning about, I'm like, yes, that's it. It's, you know, how we, you know, our lives are pretty chaotic. Things happen. But our brains are hardwired to find structure in that chaos. And so knowing that our brains are trying to make a story out of everything that we experience, we're trying to put a narrative to it, we can have some say over that. And we can, you know, emphasize certain parts of the data more so than others to make that coherent narrative, and we can point it in a direction. And so what you said is, you know, what story do I tell myself about this? What's my core piece of the story, and how do I fit all of the, you know, the data that's relevant into that narrative? That makes a huge difference in how we see ourselves, how we get through trauma, how we communicate these things to other people and connect with other people around these narratives. And it's really powerful, and it's a skill. You know, sometimes it comes naturally to people. But then sometimes it comes naturally to people in a way that's constantly a negative narrative rather than one that we can maybe formulate that helps us think about ourselves in a more positive way. I would also guess that through all of this loss that you have, you also maybe have insight into grief. Is that true? Do you feel like you have a perspective on grief that you have the ability to empathize or be compassionate with people who've had these kinds of sudden losses?
I do, for sure, I think, gained kind of different perspective on grief and on loss And I think that that's probably been one of the things that I have tried to take out of the experiences, one of the ways that I have tried to interpret my experiences when I've had them, is kind of what can I learn from this, or what can I gain from this, or take for out of this that would help me in my work with others, and try to figure out what it is in my current experience that would help me to connect better with others, or help me to understand kind of what others are going through. It's just not even something as extreme as loss, but having moved multiple times, with the most recent move to Fresno, after spending time in multiple cities and then coming into Fresno where I didn't know anybody, and trying to form community. And one of the things that I tried to think to myself is, what does this kind of resonate with? Which people might I be able to understand their experience better? And I was thinking, when we have our vets and others who are coming home after a tour of duty or after some other extended leave, and they're coming back, even if they're coming in back into their same community, technically, it's different. It's a different place, a different world. And so they're out of their community that they've known, and trying to reintegrate into it. And it's kind of, how do you know where to start, where to go, or where to connect with? And so just being able to have kind of that emotional connection when I am talking with folks or when I'm writing to people, I think that that helps to be able to have that state of mind, or at least some sense of what that emotionally might be like for them.
Wow. And I also know a little bit about one of your hobbies that I think is probably also coming out of this making meaning framework, and that's your work with rescue animals. Can you talk a little bit about your photography work with them and how that maybe connects to your life narrative?
Indeed. I think for animals, I've just always, animals kind of pull at my my inner child. So I feel much more at ease kind of when I'm working around, either just kind of touring at the zoo or when I'm working with the rescues. And one of the things that I found is I'm just naturally kind of drawn towards the ones who seem to have more of a need for compassion. So when I'm going through the shelter or going through the yards and see one that is kind of really shy or kind of off in the distance, that's the one that I'm kind of more drawn to try to spend more time with, to give some compassion to. And it's just kind of a natural inclination that I have that's there, either if I'm working with the dogs or if I'm working with individuals, like when I was doing internship at the psychiatric hospital, the wards that I liked working with the most were the ones that folks had kind of given up on, because I don't really give up on people, and tried to figure out what their life stories were and what their goals and dreams were. And when you go in and you have the belief that somebody is valuable, and that you haven't given up on them, people can kind of read that and feel that. And so it makes a little bit of a difference when you're going in for therapy as well. So I think that just kind of a part of my natural self. And so that goes into when I'm doing my work with the animals. But it's a great hobby to take my mind off of some of the more core work that I do, is doing photography for the Animal Rescue Foundation.
Fabulous. Love it. Would you send me a couple of your favorite pictures so I can post some of those animal pictures up on the landing page for the podcast?
Sure will.
Great. So tell us a little bit more about kind of where your journey is headed today, kind of what fuels your passion, what you're trying to do, you know, some of your challenges, disappointments professionally, currently in their current life, and how you're moving forward through that.
Well, I think one of the things that that I try to tell myself and try to tell others when I'm writing is that you don't really know what's going to be around the corner. And that's something that I've taken from my life. And another lesson, actually, that I've gained from traumatic loss is just the idea that nothing can really be taken for granted. You have now, and you have the past that you can learn from, but the future is so much unwritten. but you kind of just need to do the best that you can for now. And you don't really know what's coming around the corner. So like in January of 2014, I was very suicidal and really wanted to just be done with life and living. But if I had gone at that point in time, then I wouldn't have become the chair for the attempt survivor mm-hmm. and lived experience division. I wouldn't have been able to finish the way forward. Mm-hmm. There are so many things that I probably would have missed out on being able to go to Australia later. And then in 2015, I had really been thinking that summer and my trip to Australia was going to be done. And then I would just kind of check out after that summer was done. But around that same time, as it turned out, in August, right after I got back from the Australia trip, was when the Voice Awards were taking place. And so yep. a little bit earlier in the summer, they told me, hey, you're getting a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Voice Awards. So it's one of those things where you don't really know what's coming after a certain point in time. It's hard to predict when things might turn for you. And so that's what I try to tell folks when I'm working. Yep.
I was just going to say that for those of you who don't know, the Stamps of Voice Awards are probably one of the most prestigious awards for mental health and suicide prevention, about really lifting up lived experience as a way forward for other people to get inspired. So, and you did an award video from that. That's on their website, right? I'll connect that so people can see kind of what your acceptance speech was like. Right, exactly. So, you know, it's always sometimes like you're in the pit of like, I can't do it anymore. And then, boop, sometimes right then, this unexpected turn comes and you're like, well, I guess I'll just keep going, you know, having hope for now kind of thing. So tell us a little bit about your work. What are you working on? And what's kind of your source of passion for that? What are you looking ahead for in terms of how you're making meaning with your work now to help others?
You know, the project that I'm working on now is kind of something that's been a very long-term project. It's developing a college mental health book series with some student co-authors, and it's just kind of meant to be relatively short books, but that focus on how do you get through college successfully as a student if you're struggling with depression or if you're struggling with eating disorder, if you're struggling with anxiety issues. And so just kind of from their perspective, so the student co-authors are folks who are now juniors or above who have been going through college with those issues. And so they're able to give kind of their own perspective as well as talk to it from their own lived experience with going through that. And then I add my part for just kind of getting through college in general and just kind of the suicide prevention component for it. So it's been a long-term project. And one of the things that keeps me going for it over the years and over the various barriers or pitfalls and challenges that we've had is thinking back to that college version of me and what I would have really benefited from. And I can still really feel the pain and loss and frustration and feeling like there was just nothing out there and nobody who really understood what it was like to try to go to class when you're not be able to get your meds or, you know, you really just want to sleep or you have such fatigue either from side effects of medication or from the symptoms of the illness. And so just trying to connect with who that was, who I was and what I needed, and knowing that there are a lot of students out there right now who could really use that type of advice too.
Oh, I love it. I didn't even know you were doing this. This is fantastic. And so a couple of things on that front. One is, you know, I think it's super important for us to start early, you know, college and younger, about talking about resilience, about talking about living with mental health condition, about coping, about what to expect, about managing things long term. You know, and not deny that that's happening and wait until people are in this catastrophic state midlife build those skills and those expectations on earlier. And the other thing that I'm thinking about is, well, you're part of our men's anthology project as well. You submitted your story to our book, Guts, Grit, and the Grind, which we, the editors, are hoping to crank out the final manuscript to turn into our publisher by the end of this month. And for me, I have that same process, you know, because I always say if my brother had some other peers in his life who said, I'm going through something similar, you know, I don't know everything, but I know what has helped me. If he had a few people like that in his life, I swear he'd still be here. But he was all alone, thinking he was the only one that was going through that. So thank you so much for this work. Let's transition a little bit now to the science, because I know you have also a lot to share on that front. What does the research tell us about this process of making meaning and what that does to our recovery journeys?
Sure. So I think I wrote a little bit about this in The Way Forward, not as much as I would have liked to, but there are so many things that I would have liked to expand in there. But for one of the core values that we talk about in there is the fostering hope and helping people to find meaning and purpose in life. And that's based around some of the work from Linehan and then follow up by David Jobes and his colleagues around reasons for living. And one of the things that they found is that that is one of the major counters for hopelessness, is having those reasons for living, reasons that would counter the ones that would be reasons for dying. The other thing that I tried to pull from was some of the positive psychology literature. The handbook that I had at the time, Handbook for Positive Psychology for Baumeister, talked about how people find meaning and what that pursuit of meaningfulness in life is like. The research kind of says now that if you have a belief that life is meaningful, then there's increased happiness, increased well-being, increased life satisfaction, less negative emotion, less depression, anxiety, suicidal ideation, and less substance abuse. So there's a lot of research, particularly in the positive psychology field, that has connected this idea of meaning and purpose with things that are really still in line with either decreasing risk factors or increasing protective factors that are related to suicide.
Ah, I love it. And you just made me think of the fact that, when I was doing my research for my blog on hope, I came across this website, hopeoptimism.com. It's funded by the John Templeton Foundation. And I think if you haven't found it yet, listeners and to Quincy, it is amazing. So basically, they've underwritten this forum to bring together researchers, philosophers, practitioners, artists, but mostly researchers, to have these conversations about how hope and optimism factor into our health and well-being. And it talks exactly about the things you're talking about here, about these positive psychology pieces and how sometimes, you know, some people are maybe a little bit more hardwired to that than others. And sometimes the people who are hardwired to that are actually not seeing reality. They're not really, you know, they're overly optimistic, but that works for them in a number of ways. In terms of their health. So share a little bit more. Why should people be hopeful in today's world where it just seems like everything's gone mad? How do we cultivate this hope? How do we foster this hope or foster it in one another?
Yeah, so I would say that there's kind of there's hope and there's kind of meaningful, having meaning out of something. I see them as kind of being related, but not necessarily overlapping all the time. I think that meaning, the research, the ones who are kind of focusing on it conceptually have focused on if folks can kind of understand or comprehend what's happening in their life and where they fit within it, having some purpose or feeling like they have some significance or connection to something that's a little bit greater and themselves, being dedicated to some important cause or some ideal that transcends kind of their normal type of experience. But it's comprehension and finding significance. And that goes back to that personal narrative. It's, you know, if you define yourself as being kind of overcome by the traumatic experiences that have happened to you, or if you define yourself as having overcome adversity, and if you define yourself as having overcome adversity, then the folks have greater adjustment after that. There's kind of a special field that's developed around event appraisals that say, particularly for adverse or traumatic ones, that the better outcomes happen when somebody finds meaning in them. So it's being able to identify what has happened and figure out kind of how that could fit within your personal story in a way that kind of becomes a more coherent narrative. Because if it's disjointed, if it doesn't match up, then it just creates more problems.
Absolutely. And I think in my own journey, when I'm faced with a hard thing, so part of me goes to, okay, let's pause for a second here. What do I learn here about myself? Like what insights do I have about myself and maybe my failings, not as a self-critical thing, but how I can do better. And how do I kind of position myself moving forward in something that plays upon my strengths or where I feel more comfortable. And then when you get to the other side of that, there is this kind of that hero's journey kind of mentality of, yes, I had to go through those trials and tribulations to be stronger, to be better, to do better in the world. And I think when you can get to that part of your narrative where you can kind of put those things together and have that insight of an arc that puts you ahead because of your struggle, your despair, your experiences, that's a really more positive, hopeful narrative to stand on. And then also, you're less afraid when despair is looming again in the forefront, you know? And if you have that hero's journey mentality, like, okay, I've been through something similar like this before, I'll find my way through. I'll find my guides and my amulets and, you know, my mentors and my coping. And together, we're going to figure out our way through the wilderness, something along those lines. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about, I love your piece about finding significance in something larger than yourself. I know from working with the suicide attempt survivor lived experience community, this is so huge. So many people talk about kind of this role of advocacy, this role of connecting to advocating for people with lived experience is a really big part of healing. And I'm just wondering if you can talk at all about that.
For sure. I think it is. I think I also want to go back to what you were saying about kind of gaining strength afterwards, because that really connects to that post-traumatic growth concept, but also called kind of adversarial growth or stress-related growth or just thriving simply. But so that's something else that kind of positive psychology folks have been touching on, and I think Melinda Moore's research has also been looking at that. Regarding loss survivors and how you kind of might be able to find some growth either after traumatic stress or after traumatic loss has kind of happened. But what they really found is that it depends on the positive reappraisal of it and adaptation, and if you gain knowledge or a new perspective after having it. There was one study that looked at HIV patients and found that those who internalized more stigma had less post-traumatic growth, but those who had been able to share successfully and get kind of emotional support had greater post-traumatic growth, and so they were able to incorporate into their experience something that made their life afterwards stronger than it was at the beginning. So I think that what you really have conceptually is that you have this traumatic event that happens. And it creates a challenge. It creates a disruption in your sense of self. And then from there, you can either just kind of go back to where you were before, so recover, and maybe it becomes something that's just seen as an anomaly, something that's not really going to be part of your life. It's just a one-time event that happened. I think probably most people might fit into that category. You have some folks who might go on to become more disrupted from it, and so you might even develop like a post-traumatic stress disorder or some of the other types of adjustment issues. And then some folks who will take it and integrate it into the experience and then become stronger, and that's what I really want to have more people be helped to get to that point. If it is going to be something that has an impact on somebody's life, I would rather have it go in that direction of the growth direction.
Excellent. And in your clinical work, do you find that this is something people are able to learn either on their own or through therapy and counseling, about how to integrate these experiences into their narrative and think about them from a growth perspective?
I don't do much clinical work anymore, but I do a lot of training and teaching and writing, and I've found that a number of people are starting to get to the point where they can achieve that growth. I think so similar to the study with the HIV patients, one of the things that we have to counter is that stigma, because one of the pathways to growth and to making meaning out of experience is being able to share it with others, because a lot of our meaningfulness comes through connections and relationships. So being able to share it with others and not feel like you're going to be judged for it, but being supported into integrating that into your life. If it's something that has to be hidden, then it's hard to integrate that into your life. If it's something that can be shared with others and can be kind of more openly part of your life, then it's easier to integrate that into your whole self-concept and to grow from there.
And I know some people would argue that, you know, so similarly with HIV and sometimes still with HIV and still with chronic and severe mental health conditions, or sometimes any mental health condition, like discrimination is a real thing. Prejudice is a real thing. There's reasons why people are self-protecting by not disclosing to others. So they're kind of caught sometimes in feeling like they're going to be harmed if they share, harmed if they don't share. How do you help people, or how would you recommend that people find some safe spaces to at least initially disclose in a way that they are going to be able to reduce the stigma that they have, self-stigma, and also not experience the public stigma that other people have?
I think that what I would advise is to start with the writing, similar to what I had done just kind of naturally.
Love it.
Because when you're writing it, it doesn't have to go to another person, but it's still getting out of you onto some other type of way. So it's expressing it in a way that you can come back to it if you want to and try to make some meaning out of it or try to find some connections within it. But it's being able to express it is part of making meaning out of it and making some sense out of what has happened to you, some sense of that out of that experience. And if you could just find somebody who you could share it with, it could be a therapist, it could be a support group, being able to find even just a small circle of people or even just an individual who you can trust to share that with is another step in that journey of being able to make some meaning out of it. It doesn't have to be kind of big public disclosure. It could be just kind of small-level disclosure. Even that has a lot of benefit for folks.
Oh, that's fantastic. So let's move into some of the strategy and takeaway pieces, one being writing notes to yourself, writing letters to other people that you may or may not ever share with them. But are there other structured practices around journaling or tips that you have for people who've never done it before or quite kind of don't know how to get started?
For sure. I'd say I'd want our audience to kind of have three tips. One is just kind of for general folks. One is that words matter a lot. And so for some of my talks, I've tried to say I'd like to shift our field from saying things like a tempter, where it makes it seem like somebody is just going to keep attempting suicide over and over again, to just suicide attempt survivor, where it says what has happened to them. They've survived a suicide attempt, but it doesn't define them as something that is going to continue on, or having failed a suicide attempt, or having completed a suicide. So just kind of the word choice, I think, matters. And so when we are, if we have a trauma and we are journaling about it, feel free to revise the words that get stated, and we kind of see how you are thinking about something, how you are constructing that narrative in your head by the word choices that you are putting down on paper. And so you can revise it and change how you are thinking about your experience based on even just the word choices that are going into there. So the words matter. That would be kind of the first thing. The second thing is that choosing to live is not the same as refraining from dying. I think that some folks might feel like if somebody is not dying, they have reasons to not die is the same as having reasons to live, but I don't think that's the case. I think that when somebody has meaning and purpose, then they have a reason for living, a reason to connect to life, and that's a very different circumstance. It's a very more hopeful and more meaningful circumstance than just having a reason to not die. There have been a lot of times where I might say, I am not going to die because I need to take care of my kids. But it's not the same thing as having a definite reason for pursuing life or pursuing or choosing to live, choosing to have hope. So I would kind of gear therapists towards looking at not just making sure that somebody doesn't want to die, but seeing what it is that makes them want to live, what makes them want to pursue having more of a life or a future, because that's a future-oriented perspective and that's more meaningful. And then the third thing is if a suicide or suicidal experience is having an impact in somebody's life, then having it be integrated into a meaningful story and having it be integrated in a way that is that you can comprehend, that makes sense to you, and something that makes it more positive is really the ideal for moving forward in a healthy way.
Woo! All right. Wow. Thank you so much for all of this. Let me just see if I can summarize some of the themes that we've talked about here. And as I do, be thinking about some final words for our listeners. We started off talking about hope as kind of this defiant superpower against despair. Kind of what defines hope is different from optimism or common sense or some of these other things, and that there may be some daily practices that we can consciously choose to engage in to make ourselves more hopeful. You started off the podcast by sharing your personal story, and I just want to thank you for that. I know it's a story that you've told for a while now, but I do think it's important that every time someone is sharing a vulnerable story like the one you shared with us, that we express our gratitude for trusting the process or trusting our relationships and the courage sometimes that it takes to do that and to be vulnerable so that we can create many different narratives of hope and recovery. So thank you for that. And I just, this idea of writing as an expression of in the process of making meaning, I think is a very practical tip that people can take away with. And writing can come in all different forms. It can be like in just a paper-bound journal. It could be through tape recording your own voice. It can be through creating music or art. There's lots of different ways that we can start to write down the processes that are happening in our head. I loved your point about having a researcher mindset of kind of looking at your life in a way that you're gathering data and trying to understand what's happening. And you've clearly done that with the many, many unimaginable losses and traumas that you've experienced over your life. And choosing instead from saying this is something you're attracting to saying you're leading an extraordinary life that has put you in touch with people who are also leading extraordinary lives and that you're learning from each of these losses in a way that helps you connect and empathize with other people in their loss, in their trauma, and also in their transitions. I love the thought of you doing photography with these rescued animals and the fact that you're drawn to some of the ones that are in most need of love and compassion. And I'm sure your beautiful photographs help these rescue animals find a loving home because you're able to kind of capture their beauty because you're able to connect with them and put them at ease as you're taking their picture. I also agree that this whole concept of, just wait when you're thinking that you can't hold on anymore, because sometimes what's right around the corner is something you've never expected. That's a hard thing to do sometimes, because what depression does, it's so wicked. It just takes away any feeling or ability to think that there might be something hopeful or pleasurable on the other side. So it sometimes has to be a little bit of an abstract process to really hold on to that hope about something coming around the corner. I will definitely be putting up a number of these resources on the podcast homepage, The Reasons for Living, Marsha Linehan's work, hopeoptimism.com, some of the things we're talking about with Melinda Moore's research. If you could also send me that HIV study, I'd appreciate it. And I'll certainly kind of concisely kind of put together your three takeaways about the words that matter. About choosing to live a fully engaged life is not the same as just avoiding being unsafe and being at risk for death, that we really need to focus on creating a life worth living, and then finding ways to integrate those life experiences into, you know, that hero's journey piece. So love this conversation, DeQuincy. Any final thoughts that you have as we move towards the end of our time together?
Sure. I guess I'd end with this poem that I've really come to love, and so it's actually posted on my wall here. It's Invictus by William Ernest Henley, and he wrote it, after he had gotten his leg amputated, and they told him he had to get the other one amputated too, and he chose to go kind of a different route. But so it says, out of the night that covers me, black as the pit from pole to pole, I thank whatever gods may be for my unconquerable soul. Fell clutch of circumstance, I have not winced nor cried aloud. Under the bludgeonings of chance, my head is bloody, but unbowed. Beyond this place of wrath and tears looms but the horror of the shade, and yet the menace of the years finds and shall find me unafraid. It matters not how straight the gate, how charged with punishments the scroll. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. It's a poem that I really like because it really emphasizes that the part that we have control over is how we interpret things, the narrative that we make out of the experiences that we have, and that what really defines how we move forward. And I'd like folks to carry that with them, that they have that that choice and that ability to make that choice.
Oh. That is such a great thing. And I love how we both opened and ended with poems, this idea of the unconquerable soul. Like life, you can throw crap at me, you can beat me up, but you know what? You can't touch the thing that's really inside that is unconquerable. And you are certainly a living truth of that phrase. And it is my privilege and honor to call you my friend. And I can't wait to see you soon again at one of the many meetings where we cross paths. As always in my encounters with you, DeQuincy, I have felt, well, first of all, I've learned a ton, both about your kind of personal story and some of the things that you're thinking about. Always feel very inspired and, you know, connected to you. I love partnering with you. I think we have a really good friendship and partnership on many fronts, and I just want to let you know that I'm very grateful to you for that. To the listeners, we will have these resources on the website, so come at SallySpencerThomas.com, the links, and you can get there also through the iTunes portal, the different resources that we've talked about and so forth. Thank you so much, all the listeners, for showing up for this conversation. We're recording this in December right now, you know, and I think sometimes people facing the holiday season you know, experience a disconnect sometimes if they're going through a really hard time and yet the world around them tells them that they need to be celebratory and cheerful. Well, that's really hard to do if you're living with depression or you've experienced a loss or a trauma or things are just not going your way. And so I think this podcast theme is timed well to maybe help people find their unconquerable soul in the middle of some things that might be a little bit hard. For more episodes, please go to iTunes, Hope Illuminated Podcast, where you can subscribe. If you please would leave a rating and review, this helps other people looking for podcasts find ours. Periodically, I'll do a gift card drawing for people who've left ratings and reviews to thank you for doing that. Please also go to my website, SallySpencerThomas.com, sign up and get the newsletter. I have monthly Twitter chats. We do this monthly podcast. I have two or three blogs a month that I'm putting out there, plus webinars through United Suicide Survivors International. So with all that said, let me close with our motto and call to action. Open your heart, challenge your thinking, and take action to save lives. Together we can restore dignity and sustain a passion for living. Until next time, take care.
And now, insurance-minded speeches from GEICO.
It's a common expression, don't look a gift horse in the mouth. However, what if the horse's mouth is filled with useful insurance tools? This is the exact case with the GEICO app. Yes, the app is free and therefore a gift horse. However, look inside the app and behold, emergency roadside assistance, digital ID cards, bill pay. Get the GEICO app. Look it in the mouth. Get amazing services. Thank you.